How do you do?
Oh, I suppose you're the undertaker that's come for the money for that casket.
No, madam, I'm from the Bible Association. Mr. O'Hara ordered this Bible.
Mr. O'Hara is dead. Bible. Sure, if he's gone where I think he has, it's a cake of ice he'll be needing.
Okay. Are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No, no, no. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And may I introduce my cohort, the man behind the Forgotten Horrors books and so many more things, and I think if you haven't already used it, too humorous to mention, Mr. Michael H. Price. And Michael, tonight or today, we're talking about one of the films that you seem to be very high on. A film I don't think has actually gotten a legitimate DVD release, is that correct?
That's correct.
It's a film called Cross Country Cruise, a Universal picture.
If one caught it in TV syndication several years ago, that's probably about the best you're going to get, but there's always the old reliable deep search on the Internet.
And when did this come out?
1934.
So right at the time that the motion picture code got some teeth.
It's right about that time, and it's, of course, right in the big middle of the... Right in the big middle of the glory days of gothic melodrama at Universal Pictures,
right,
which survived the censorship code, but didn't survive the new ownership of Universal years later.
I guess that's probably true. I never thought about that, but you're right. That's when it went away, didn't it?
Yeah, the gothics were a great favorite, both commercially and personally, of the founder, Carl Limley.
Mm-hmm.
And Limley, of course, made it possible for the first cycle of horror films, apart from Silence, that had been produced without any sense of a genre.
Mm-hmm.
It was Limley who introduced the gothic horrors with Dracula and Frankenstein in 1931, coming off many such pictures of the silent years, but finally codifying that sense of an emerging genre. And the funny thing is, you find elements of those gothic horrors in many Universals that apparently have nothing to do with the boogeyman.
Including this one.
Including this one, yes.
Which, and if I may basically do the brief synopsis... I've called it a Greyhound Grand Hotel. It's a bee picture, and it's a story of a cross-country bus cruise where they actually stop off from time to time and rent hotel rooms for a couple of hours and have dinner parties and then go on, and it stars a B-movie superstar, Lou Ayres.
Lou Ayres, definitely, who had not yet become identified with Dr. Kildare.
Yes.
And, of course, marked a very ambitious comeback for Alice White.
And she's the second female lead.
Right, exactly. She made her comeback not as the musical star she had been, but as the, it's what Hollywood casting authorities used to call the Dizzy Dame roles. And of course, she just steals the show from top female lead June Knight.
You know, fate seems to have thrown us together.
I thought fate had thrown you up with a driver.
Oh, you know how it is. A girl traveling alone has to be taken care of.
Well, you just stick around, Miss Bronson's little boy, Willie. You're just the kind of a girl to fit right under my wing.
When do we have our first fitting?
Right. Did June Knight do a lot after that?
Not to speak of, nobody really graduated from this picture to major league stardom, although June Knight did work up until the 40s, and she lived a long and, long retired, but she attained an advanced age. I believe she died at 74.
Right.
Her last picture as an actress looks to have been a thing called The House Across the Bay. And that was after a dry spell. That was in 1940, after a dry spell during the tail end of the 30s.
Well, she's very cute in this, and you know, there's so many conventions in this picture that really seem new, but obviously weren't. The whole idea of meeting a cute, June Knight's suitcase falls into Lou Ayer's car, and her dainties fall out. That's exactly right. And then there's the whole deal that, of course, people remember from Paper Moon about the Bible salesman scam. And I thought that was a very interesting part of this picture, is that a couple of the characters were into that old deal where they would scan the obituaries and go to these towns and tell people, well, your husband or your wife ordered this beautiful Bible before they died, and we didn't know that they were gone, and we'll go on and just, oh no, if they ordered it. And then the whole thing that Ryan O'Neill and Tatum O'Neill do in Paper Moon.
I'd like to speak to Mrs. Collins, please.
Mrs. Collins? Why, Mrs. Collins?
All right, Walter. Here's something about Mrs. Collins.
Yes, I'm from the Bible Association. Mrs. Collins ordered this Bible.
But my wife has passed away.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I sympathize with you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you.
Well, then, of course, you won't want this.
Oh, wait. If she wanted it, I'm going to take it. How much is it?
$25.
Come inside. I'll give you a check.
Oh, yeah. That, and of course, that's based on a true scam of the Depression years.
Sure.
It's quite amazing how you look back at these pictures of some antiquity. They shouldn't seem all that antiquated.
No, they shouldn't.
In the modern day, but in too many people they do, and you see subtext. You know, that's funny. We did the monthly film club. First Sunday Film Club in Fort Worth over the weekend, and screened Gene Autry's breakout picture of just the following year after Cross Country Cruise, The Phantom Empire. And the audience got a big kick out of it. They were really flashing on the significance of this picture. It's like, well, you know, one guy said, well, this is the picture without which there'd have been no Star Wars, no Raiders of the Lost Ark, etc. But one viewer, and I wish I'd thought of this, a lot of people always laugh about Gene Autry's utter commitment to wrapping up these big fights and sieges real quick so he can get back to the ranch and do his radio show. one of the members of the audience says, why, that can only speak to the anxiety among Depression era audiences of losing their property, of losing their jobs, of losing, because you'll note that Gene says we got to get back to the ranch and do our show, or we'll lose our contract and the ranch.
Losing it to adversity.
Yes, social relevance in a picture designed for escapism, but of course it was speaking to that working class audience.
Sure. Do you see
and
that?
Just what Cross Country Cruise does, it is a working class film. The nominal hero, Lou Ayers, is of course a rich guy slumming among the working class.
A great archetype or stereotype.
Almost a Steinbeckian character,
yes.
Although Lou Ayers, you know, he's no Henry Fonda, but but he gets this across. Yeah, he's being punished by his wealthy father and ordered to go work at one of
camp.
The family's logging camps.
Yeah, logging camp, right.
And this is an amazing touch of social relevance in the midst of escapism. You see the hucksters, Alan Dinehart and Minna Gombel, preying on the working class bereaved with this Bible scam.
Yes.
And you see all these mixed, basically incompatible people on this bus learning how to get along or not to get along. on this marathon tour. You know, it's not only a reflection of Grand Hotel in a blue collar setting. It's also a foreshadowing of John Ford's Stagecoach, which came along 4 years later.
And really a great metaphor for the Depression.
Definitely a great metaphor for the Depression, because what they used to call riding the dog.
Mm-hmm.
That is the Greyhound cross-country bus trip.
Uh-huh.
That was just about a step up from hitchhiking.
Yeah, still is.
Yes, exactly. It's a wonderful, wonderful metaphorical picture, and of course you can always read too much into it, like I tend to do.
Right. It's better to read too much than too little, though, isn't it?
Better to over-intellectualize a picture than just sit there and say, so what?
Well, as long as we're over-intellectualizing it, or we're making comparisons to Grapes of Wrath, Jane Darwell, one of the Bible.
Flashed back to me just right before you said that, of course. And Jane Darwell never brought less than top notch to her performance.
Even in those AIP things she did in the 50s.
She always seemed just holding back tears.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, every time you see Jane Darwell, although she is kind of the one that gets upper hand on the Bible salesman,
mm-hmm.
the bogus Bible salesman, but, you know, every Jane Darwell performance, I guess, is probably you consciously or subconsciously think of the scene in Grapes of Wrath when Ma Jo is getting rid of all the, trying to decide what to take and putting the earrings on and throwing the postcards away.
That's one of the most
powerful. It's powerful in the book, of course, the scene.
Mm-hmm. How that movie brought the book to life.
It did indeed. Very seldom does that happen. But we were talking about cross-country cruise, and one of the things that I noticed about cross-country cruise is that it must be right before the Breen, Joseph Breen, really put teeth in the code, because there's some stuff that maybe a few months later, double entendres or, you know, things about lingerie.
The whole business with the underwear, of course,
right.
that picture, Cross Country Cruise, was released in January, and that was about 6 months before the censorship code got its teeth.
Really, yeah, really, really got teeth. And even the idea that people may be living together without benefit of clergy, you couldn't have done 6 months later, you know, when you really got down to it. A lot of the one-liners are a little salacious.
Mae, that's your whole fare to California. Listen, there's so little money in New York, I hate to take any away. But what are you going to do? A girl can't summer way to the coast. Can't what? Summer way. Oh, you know, give the guy some thumb. The guy don't live there to be satisfied with just a girl's thumb.
It just seems to be one of those great, and I, you know, the more I watch movies, the more I love those pre-code films from 32 and 33. And now early 34.
Sure.
You know, they were getting by with stuff, kind of like the old blues guys, the old Western swing guys. They were getting by with stuff that they would usually have not gotten by with in polite society.
Right. And of course, the audience was able to either let a zinger like that fly right over their heads, or they would... Hey, I get that. I know what that means.
And they were probably a little bit more naive, you know. And there were the guys who knew in the audience, the people who knew, the faster element of the audience probably knew, and it probably flew right over the heads of the others. But we're talking about the horror. This is a horror podcast, and if I may state your thesis for you, and you can state it more elegantly than I can, probably. But you're a big proponent of the Lovecraftian idea that horror is where you find it. And this, for most of its running time, is not a horror film. It's a story, as you say, of a lot of people put together on a bus with little adventures, little romances happening. And then, about two-thirds of the way into it, there's a very scary set of scenes.
Oh, yeah. Well, you get the very clear signal that the leading lady, June Knight has been having an illicit affair with this married con artist,
yes,
Alan Dinehart.
Alan Dinehart, right.
And, of course, he and his wife, actually, he and June Knight had intended to meet and take the bus. When his wife shows up, it creates a whole different dynamic because she's keeping tabs on him.
Right.
And, of course, that point where the confrontation between estranged spouses, who up until now have been partners in crime, takes place, it's like, oh, my goodness, did I just see what I thought I saw?
Yes, yes.
And of course, don't let's give away too much of the game, but
right.
The picture takes off into a really horrific tangent. And then sets up the final act, which is not only the escape of a culprit, but also the discovery of the crime and the cross-country manhunt following the bus.
Right, right.
An amazing thing. And then, of course, the complications where the perpetrator attempts to frame an innocent party.
That's right.
A lot of complications here for a very, very brisk running time, like 72 minutes.
It doesn't seem that. It seems very, very quick. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
And, is the speed, do you know the director, Edward Bazell, I guess was his
name? He was a comedian. Actually, he had a Broadway musical comedy pedigree.
Before he came
to Eddie Bazell. Uh-huh. was a songwriter, started out as a kid actor, and had a good resume, not an extensive resume,
mm-hmm.
but his director credentials include titles like Hollywood Speaks,
oh,
Love,
yes.
Honor, and Oh Baby. What, Paradise for Three, Fast Company, Best Foot Forward, all these pictures that do not bespeak a picture of such intensity as we get in Cross Country Cruise.
But a picture that's as breezy, perhaps, pictures that are as breezy as Cross Country Cruise.
Oh, yeah. Well, now that's, and it has its breezy moments as well. The wonderful subplot of the man-hungry character played by Alice White. She's dizzy, but she's got a purpose.
And she's the one that takes up with the lecturer, correct?
She takes up with anybody who,
right? That's true.
And then of course, winds up in completely other circumstances at the end of the picture, which kind of brings everything full circle. And that beautiful, loud-mouthed, know-it-all grouch played by the great grouch Eugene Paulette,
yes,
who develops eyes for Alice White's character,
mm-hmm.
he's got a backstory that comes full circle at the end. So you get all these pieces tied up.
And he's the lecturer. He's the one that likes to lecture about the falls and likes to be that guy, right?
He likes to be the one who is in charge, whether or not he is.
Right. That's right. And just makes everybody crazy.
And of course, he's got that nice little surprise comeuppance at the end.
Yes,
that
yes.
I knew there was something I didn't like about that guy.
What is it about this film that intrigues you? I know it's a favorite of yours, and I'm curious about it. I mean, I love the film. It moves very quickly. It, as you say, it goes off into a macabre, certainly, territory.
Mm-hmm. I came to the film, I guess in the 80s when I was trying to get a look at every Universal made during the Limley period.
Yes.
During Carl Limley's reign as president of Universal Pictures. I was initially looking for tastes or aftertastes of the Gothic horror interest. And, of course, you find that in, how about James Whale? What else did he do besides the two initial Frankensteins at Universal and some other pictures of that significance?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he did Showboat. And, of course, the response is, Showboat? I hate musicals. Well, you won't watch a Whale picture and come away disappointed.
No.
He did dramas. He did that really great filming of Showboat, which MGM ended up suppressing in order to get their own inferior version out in the 50s. Whale did took a wonderful novel called The Hangover Murders.
Oh, that's the one where everybody's drunk when someone gets killed and they're all hung over and nobody knows who did it.
Yes, and of course filmed it under the title Remember Last Night.
Remember Last Night. Yeah.
And of course you look closely at Remember Last Night and there's a distinct literal reference in there to Bride of Frankenstein, which was of course Whale's big picture of the moment.
Right, right.
And so you find in these universals, no matter what genre they belong to, you find that sense of Germanic, Gothic darkness creeping in at every corner. Look at the great Ken Maynard westerns from Universal during the early 30s. All good shoot 'em ups, and frequently they veer into the macabre.
Right, right.
And of course, Buck Jones's masterpiece, The Crimson Trail.
People say you can't
have a horror movie and a western at the same time. It's like, oh, I beg to differ.
Well, Smoking Guns is right up there.
yeah, cowboy shoot 'em up involving mistaken identity, right. Deceit and deception in disguise, Halloween night in a haunted house.
Right, right. And even something, as you say, like Cross Country Cruise, whose advertising and press material gives no idea that there's any sort of a horror or mystery quality to it.
Oh, that was, of course, George Turner, with whom I initiated the Forgotten Horrors books in 1975, was very much a proponent of this picture. Says, you got to see Cross Country Cruise. You got to say, so what's so special about Cross Country Cruise? You know, a smart aleck college kid that I was. And he said, just wait until you see it. And sure enough, we got a look at it thanks to the local film society.
Well, now let's talk about that. If someone who is hearing this podcast wants to see Cross Country Cruise, how do they do it?
As I mentioned earlier, you do the deep search on the Internet, and your keywords would be, quote, Cross Country Cruise, unquote. Always put that specific phrase in quotation marks. And then you do a space, and then you do a plus sign, and then you type the letters DVD.
Because it does not have an official DVD release. Correct?
No. I know where the master negative, and an archival 35mm print are stored. And we went through all sorts of bureaucratic hassles with the present day Universal management in trying to get that released to show during a film festival.
Yes.
And it's like, well, we see no purpose in letting such a picture out at this late date. It's like, actually, probably the more archival prints you get out at this, quote, late a date, unquote, are probably going to attract more attention than the latest CGI splatfest. Which, of course, Universal just loves to do. If Uncle Carl Limley had foreseen the future of Hollywood in the long term in this bold new millennium, he'd have probably torched the dump.
Well, Michael, let's talk about. I think we're at the time of the podcast where we want to plug our stuff. What have you got to plug? I know that you've got a Voodoo Kill the Rodeo Star out, which I've been listening to and enjoying. You want to mention that?
Oh, that CD, yeah, that's a bunch of my guest shots on the Dr. Demento show.
That's what I was thinking. You kind of, those go way back, don't they?
Yeah, I've been producing material for Dr. Demento's radio show since, what, 1981, I guess?
Well, and I think horror fans will particularly like this one because you've got Jurassic Park, you've got Attack of the Giant Leeches, I believe is on that one, you've got The Haunted Strangler, you've got the Minnie the Moocher takeoff in the morgue, and you've got a lot of movie-related stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's all very much of a piece with the Forgotten Horrors books. We've been a little bit over ambitious in the recording studio lately, and we've got lots of titles to show for it. And it's like, okay, why am I indulging this creative streak when I should be working on a new volume of Forgotten Horrors? Well, hey, you know, it's there. You got to use it. I just got out the new edition of Southern Fried Homicide, the graphic novel.
Yes.
And, a lot of stuff coming together. Just now in the final proofing stages on on a book detailing the history of Rocky Jones Space Ranger.
Now, you're doing that with Jan Allen Henderson, right?
That's a Jan Henderson project, mm-hmm. and he had written the guest chapter in Forgotten Horrors, yes. Volume 5 on Rocky Jones.
And, yeah, wonderful chapter.
Figured he had amassed enough stuff for a book. I said, well, okay, let me just encourage that, and sure enough.
Well, we're getting some nice reviews on the latest two Forgotten Horrors books,
mm-hmm.
number 6 and also Nth Degree, which I'm proud of them all, but I'm very proud of the Nth Degree because
Forgotten Horrors to the Nth Degree. Boy, how much farther can you take it after that?
Well, between your Larry Buchanan homage and my Dave Friedman visit, I mean, it's just I think it's the most personal of all of the books that we've done together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we threw a lot of ourselves into those pieces. And, of course, the Buchanan thing originated some years ago, but
right.
never had been told in this comprehensive a form. And, of course, Larry Buchanan, the the creator of Mars Needs Women.
That's
what a
right.
guy.
That's right. And Zontar, the thing from Venus. And, and yet people who would just have a passing knowledge of Buchanan would have no idea of the kind of a guy that he was that you capture in your piece.
No, he was a very dear fellow, and he was very aware of the limitations of his craft. He continued making movies pretty much till the end of his life, although things tapered off after the 80s.
Well, he and Dave Friedman were a lot alike in that way. And, you know, I was
mm-hmm.
I was lucky enough, and, of course, Dave was a friend of yours, and you did a Revco video with him, if I'm not mistaken.
We shot a remarkable music video for Revco.
Yes,
Dave
I've
and
seen
I.
That.
He was a delight to be around, of course.
What a great guy! And I was lucky enough to visit him at his home in Anniston, Alabama, which he referred to as the Hollywood of the South, and see him in action because he was a carny after all, and see him in action at the Calhoun County Fair, running the Calhoun County Fair. It's a wonderful memory, and I hope that I was able to just get that sense of wonder and joy of being around Dave Friedman in the piece as you got.
Well, actually, what that piece conveys is the sense of wonder and joy that Dave Friedman had at being alive.
Yes, he did. Yes,
and
he
how
did.
That transferred. Here was a guy making the kind of pictures that, of course, our parents would have been appalled to know we were watching. 2000 Maniacs, Blood Feast, etc., etc., etc. You
sure.
went to the drive-in to see what?
She-Freak?
She-Freak, exactly.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And, of course, the beauty of Friedman's stuff was that he understood the barrier between art and life.
Yes, yes.
And he brought, in confrontational scenarios, he found escapism. That's hard
right.
to do.
That's right.
You look at a
yeah.
picture today that wouldn't exist if not for Friedman's influence. The Wrong Turn franchise, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you get the feeling that these guys really wish they were making a snuff movie.
Mm-hmm.
Friedman wouldn't have touched that kind of garbage.
No, he even stepped back from hardcore pornography because
yes.
it wasn't interesting to him.
Yes, Friedman yeah. found joy in showing you outrageous things that should not, could not exist in waking life.
And
of course, he was one of the guys who took literally the phrase dreams that money can buy.
That's right. And
sometimes they were nightmares that money can buy.
That's right. And I think of all the filmmakers I know, he is the person who understood also the relationship between the carnival and the movies.
Oh yeah, yeah, and of course the movies wouldn't exist if not for the carnival, if not for the Nickelodeon machine, if not for the boardwalk attraction. The movies came from very scruffy origins, and despite all the efforts of the highbrows to turn them into art, they don't need turning into art. They are art.
And I think Friedman understood that. I think Friedman
yeah.
understood it was essentially still a carny, a Cullen attraction, the movie was.
I learned that a long time ago when, of course, Dave knew my cousin, Bobby Jackson, who ran the Kearney for the Hames Company, the Hames Traveling Shows. And they were well acquainted with one another. It was my cousin who introduced me to the, okay, I'm going to show you how we do that gorilla girl routine now.
Yes.
It's like, wait a minute, you mean she's not really a gorilla girl? I said, well, if you're in the audience, she is. But let's go backstage. And it's like, wow, okay, I got to get in on that stuff. And, of course, Dave also understood that there is only one show business. He was as knowledgeable about the films of Federico Fellini as he was with The Grindhouse.
Absolutely.
And, of course, Fellini had his own carny origins.
He certainly did. 8 and a half is a kind of a big old carnival, too, in a lot
of ways. La Strada, mm-hmm. Knights of Cabiria, mm-hmm. all that stuff that, you know, I mean, Larry Buchanan, on the other hand, was a great expert on Bergman.
Yes. Yes, and it's very obvious in some.
And once
stuff.
In a while, tried to make a Bergman.
Tried to make a Bergman film.
And might not have come that close, but by golly, he tried.
It wasn't for lack of trying.
These were both great gentlemen of the film industry, and of course, the film industry looked askance at them because they were reminders of those scruffy origins.
But we didn't look askance at them in a forgotten horse to the nth degree, and I'd like to think it's a little bit of a memorial to those guys.
Oh, yeah.
To the
yeah,
other guys.
And,
to the other
by
guys
golly, if you're going to have to miss somebody for the rest of your life, you might as well do something to keep the memory alive.
That's exactly right. So we can find those books on Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
And anything else we need to say before we call this meeting to a close and reconvene
well, just let's remind everybody to take a look at the Forgotten Horrors podcast page on Facebook and sign on to take part. We will welcome participants.
All right. Well, we'll be back before you know it. Michael, always a pleasure. Visit with you again soon.
As a routine, this is one of my favorites.